Good morning and welcome. Thank you very much for being with us for our roundtable panel. It's the 21st of September. It's a Friday. And I just took a little poll of those in the studio, and we're all happy it's Friday. I don't know about you, but hopefully you enjoyed the day as well. We have a lot to talk about. We will do so. Let me introduce everybody and remind you, of course, that we have the ability to take your letters and read them on the radio. All you have to do is write them. panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Real quick, Judith Enck, who normally would be here, is away, and she'll be back, I think, in 2 weeks. And also Alan, who would normally be here, is away, and he'll be back in a few days. So here we go. We welcome David Soares, the district attorney from the County of Albany. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning. I, too, am happy that Friday is here, but Friday should have come on Tuesday. Just saying.
Well, from what I've read, it seems like you've had a great week.
It's been.
You know, I was thinking about this, you know, when my parents were with us, and my mother, who was just a natural worrier, would always say to me, well, I never have to worry because I always know that you made it to work safe because I could turn on the radio and I could hear you. And I would just think that, you know, we can all keep track of what you're up to.
Well, yeah, I have a little tent right underneath my desk where I hide with my gear some weeks. This was one of them.
Everyone knows what you're up to. That's pretty good. Thank you for being here. I appreciate
you.
Hopefully we'll help calm some of the storms or create new ones. I don't know. Aaron Pasitti is a professor of economics at the at Siena College of Loudonville, New York. And good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. Doing well.
Really
I can hide, unlike David. It's really easy.
Academia is much different.
It is.
And the guy who's tracking us all down and making sure that we are where we need to be is Mike Spain. He is the associate editor of the Times Union. Good morning, sir. How
good
are
morning.
You? Literally, and I say this with great deep respect and much love to Mike, I had a cancellation this morning at about 6:45, and I sent Mike a note, and within a half hour, he agreed to come in. So I just very much appreciate
I'm happy to be here.
It's very nice to have you here, so thank you very much for doing that. All right, let's I have a couple things to remind you about, two. One is that it's 3 weeks until the fund drive, October 15th. We started giving away, I think it was on Tuesday, we started to give away tickets for Capital Steps. And Capital Steps is, of course, the political comedy troupe. They come for 5 years. This will be the fifth year that they have come to us. And they do a show just for us, just for WAMCers. They do it at the Egg. This year, they're doing it the Friday after midterm elections. So the midterm elections will be on Tuesday. And then on Friday, the greatest political comedy troupe of all time will come to the Egg and make fun of what happened.
Yeah, they're going to have a lot of fast writing to do.
Yeah. It's good. You know, and we don't know what's going to happen, so they don't know what's going to happen. And we thought, so we said to them, what would be a good day? Do you want to do it before? Do you want to do it? And they go, oh, no, let's do it right after.
What rhymes with cruise?
Blues?
Impromptus?
Yeah. Excellent. So the Capital Steps going to be at the Egg Friday, November 9th. And this is a WAMC show. So how do you get tickets? You got to get them through us. And for a pledge of $150, you can get a pair of tickets. And we'll also, not only that, but at the end of it, just a little while later, you get a copy of the, you get a CD or a download of the show that you were at, that was done especially for you as a WAMC listener. It's important to note that this is sold out for every year that we've done it, and already we just started this on Tuesday. It's Friday. Already more than a quarter of the tickets are gone. So it's a big room. We have a lot of places to fill, but we still need you. It's WAMC.org. I won't make the poor people answer the phone. WAMC.org. Do it online, and you just go to the drop-down menu, and there will be a listing for the Capital Steps at the Egg on November 9th. And by the way, whatever you can do for the Lockbox, whatever you can do, is extremely helpful because every dollar we make now is money we don't need to make during the fund drive. So WAMC.org. Sound good?
That's a risky proposition, having an event the day after the elections. Well, because you're either, it's either going to be a disco or a wake.
Well, you know, it's the Friday after, so we got a couple days to sort of level the playing field. But I have to say that we did it. We had a program, the roundtable we had that we gave away during a fun drive to do the roundtable panel live. I believe Mike was a part of it. Oh, and we did it the day after the 2016 elections. We expected, I mean, you know, we had balloons and confetti, for God's sakes. And we were ready, you know. And it turned into an Irish wake. But I will say it was cathartic, and I think everyone, there was a lot of hand-holding, and people just sort of, you know, like group prayer. But it was a lovely time to get together to sort of process what had happened just a few hours prior.
Remembering democracy?
Well, that was, I think we had a moment of silence for democracy.
No, I think we were, as I recall on that fateful morning after the 2016 election, we were trying to be optimistic and expecting that the president, now that he's president, will put aside these habits of his and step up to the role and become presidential. And it wouldn't be bad. There's been presidents that some people disagree with and others favor. But, you know, it would all work out. And how's it going so far?
it's almost like Judith Inc. Rooting for Susan Collins to come around.
Yeah. Well, we'll see what... We still hold out hope, David. We still hold out hope. The other thing I just wanted to remind you about is that this morning, I briefly mentioned it during our top of the hour break, but on the roundtable, every Friday from now until the midterms, we're going to be running a series called The Democracy Test. There's a group from American Public Media, Truth, Politics, and Power, that Neil Conan, the longtime host of Talk of the Nation, and political historian Heather Richardson Cox are going to explore the state of our democracy this election season. They have the 6-part series, and they're going to be looking at examples of similar and often more dangerous challenges in American history and how our democracy has saved them and what that knowledge may do to help us solve our current difficulties. It's a very well done series, and we wanted to make room for it, so we're going to air it every Friday. So at 11:00 this morning, we'll hear the first episode of that. So just a programming note for you this morning, and then now it is time to actually get to the program that you tuned in for, and that is what we'll do right now. So. Let me, this is the story that's been the story for the last week, and that is, of course, the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh. Brett Kavanaugh is, of course, the nominee for the Supreme Court. Now, the question is, what will happen next week? Here's what we know right now. The accuser of Brett Kavanaugh has said she will not testify on Monday, but is open to doing so later week. An attorney for Christine Blasey Ford, the woman who has accused Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh of sexually assaulting her when they were teenagers, said Thursday that her appearing in a hearing on Monday to detail her claims is, quote, not possible, but that she could testify later in the week. Deborah Katz, Ford's lawyer, relayed the response to top staffers on the Senate Judiciary Committee on Thursday, requesting to set up a call with them to discuss the conditions under which Ford would be prepared to testify next week. As you are aware, she's been receiving death threats, which have been reported to the FBI, and she and her family have been forced out of their home, Katz wrote to the committee. By the way, if there's anyone who questions whether that's true or not, just look at Twitter. And any articles about her and see, it's not pretty. And
it's disgraceful is what it is.
And by the way, this happens on both sides.
And these are no giants or people that will ever have profiles of courage done on them.
So the attorney went on to say she wishes to testify, provided that we can agree on terms that are fair and which ensure her safety. A hearing on Monday is not possible, and the committee's insistence that it occur then is arbitrary in any event. So that's where we are right now. We've been going back and forth on this for over a week, and while a lot happened in a very short period of time over last weekend. This particular part of it seems to be dragging out.
Oh, I don't think it is dragging out. I think that if she doesn't testify Monday, the Republicans who control the committee are ready, if they have enough votes, ready to hold a vote and swear in Brett Kavanaugh, you know, push it out to the full Senate and swear in Brett Kavanaugh before they go off to the recess. I think that's still the plan, although I'm not sure that's going to happen.
Well, so that's yes. So right. Meaning Chuck Grassley of Iowa said through a spokesman late Thursday that he would be consulting with colleagues on how to proceed. Kavanaugh wrote to Grassley in a letter released by the White House that he looks forward to testifying. I continue to want a hearing as soon as possible so that I can clear my name, Kavanaugh said in the letter. Since the moment I first heard this allegation, I have categorically and unequivocally denied it. I remain committed to defending my integrity. Amid the maneuvering, the nomination was roiled further late Thursday by incendiary tweets from a prominent Kavanaugh friend and supporter who publicly identified another high school classmate of Kavanaugh's as Ford's possible attacker. Ed Whalen, a former clerk to the late Justice Antonin Scalia and president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center, pointed to floor plans, online photographs, and other information to suggest a location for the house party in suburban Maryland that Forbes described. He also named and posted photographs of the classmate he suggested could be responsible.
But isn't this why Ford's requesting an FBI investigation to get past the he said, she said, and just the hot air that's been filling up?
You mean actually try to come to some
conclusions
exactly. And facts?
Right, correct. And it seems like the insistence on having it happen Monday seems to be a pretty bald form of bullying, of saying this needs to happen on Monday or else we're going through with it, as opposed to giving time for the investigation and allowing more information and facts to surface. And boy, this just reeks of fast tracking, to put it politely.
Yeah, to put it politely. Now, Dr. Ford came forward last night after this and said, there is zero chance that I would confuse them. I knew them both, socialized with. There's zero chance that I would confuse them. I don't know what happened. I don't think any of us know what happened. But if it happened, I think you know the person who sexually assaulted you.
Well, we have two issues here. First and foremost is this is perhaps one of the most important positions in our country. The decisions that are made in this court affect every single human being in our country. Those decisions govern our democracy. And so this idea that you would have a process where you would fast track a candidate last week it was a data dump, right? It was thousands and thousands of documents provided to the people who have to absolutely review this information before they can begin to intelligently inquire into this person's qualifications. So that is absolutely no way to even hire someone who's going to be making donuts, much less someone who's going to be making these very important decisions. And now we have an allegation of an impropriety, of a crime, right, that we're going to sit here and for purposes of political expediency, we're going to put political expediency above the nation and individuals, citizens hearing the full the facts of this event, and it's disgraceful. It's really disgraceful.
You know, the other thing, and I will say this, that I find it I'll say it this way: the president has been somewhat restrained over the last few days on this matter and has not said a lot. And the reports that we were getting last night from several sources inside the White House was that he is bragging about what a great job he's doing because he's so restrained. And I looked at my wife, and my wife looked at me, and she said, well, I wonder how long before he screws that up. And then today he tweets and says, if the attack on Dr. Ford was as bad as she says, then charges would have been immediately filed. Well, that's just not true.
It's just, first of all, it's not true. Second of all, the volume of cases that that both impact the clergy as well as other institutions where there's delay in reporting are astronomical. So the idea that in this instance, why wouldn't she have reported 30 plus years ago? It's just one of the more absurd remarks that came from this president. The idea that anyone would characterize Donald Trump and his behavior this week as being restrained after remarks that he made about Kavanaugh that imply that, boy, he's the victim here, to me is just it's off-putting as well.
Well, it's a relative term. He is relatively restrained. I mean, ordinarily, he probably would have attacked the accuser. And it seems almost stunning that he has been able to restrain that. And he's following the script, and he's not saying anything accusatory about the accuser. He is just saying that Kavanaugh is the best, and has full faith in him. And
I guess that too is relative, because when I hear someone, who is – when I hear someone discuss how bad they feel for the alleged assailant, that to me is also attacking the victim. So I what I've heard this week is different, because I think he's attacked her in many different ways. He just hasn't been so overt about it.
Yeah.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll have letters, and we'll talk more about this and other issues. We welcome your thoughts. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. Mike Spain is here, Aaron Pasitti, David Soares, and of course your letters. We'll talk about this, and we have other topics as well. Panel@WAMC.org. Don't forget, you can still help out the lockbox as well, WAMC.org. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning, 35 minutes past 9 o'clock. We have Mike Spain with us, Aaron Pasitti, and David Soares. I'm Joe Donahue, and we welcome your letters. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. We have a couple, like this one from Kevin, who says, this question is for David. Here we go. Could you provide some insight into why Paul Manafort is reportedly cooperating with Mueller without a lawyer present? Is this due to money or just Mueller striking the jackpot getting information? Also, I was wondering, can Manafort come back after his cooperation and say, I did not mean to give certain pertinent information because I had no lawyer? I'm sure he had to sign his name on the dotted line to discuss freely.
First of all, it's very rare that any kind of discussion with a defendant is going to be done without the presence of counsel, only because as a prosecutor, you know that very issue could be used to come back to further litigate in the event that, things don't necessarily work out the way that a defendant had intended things to work out. So the idea that any discussion with Bob Mueller's prosecutors would be done outside the presence of an attorney just doesn't seem right to me, and it doesn't seem like that is that would be a fact. Secondly, the reason why Paul Manafort would be cooperating with the people is because the evidence is so overwhelming that the risk of putting that evidence forward in a trial where there's certainty of a conviction, it's a numbers game. You certainly like the number 7, for example, more than you would like the number 70. When we're talking about sentences. And I think that for Paul Manafort, he's just looking at the rest of his life and not seeing the opportunity for him to live outside the confines of a federal facility. And so he has every incentive in the world to sit down with the Mueller team to provide cooperation on any and all subjects that the Mueller team desires to probe into.
All right. That is from Kevin. And then we have this from Tom, who said, I hear you begin this morning that you're continuing to follow the confirmation hearings in depth and almost exclusively this week. I can't help but sit here and wonder, what are we missing? While all this is going on as the bright, shiny object du jour, What legislation or executive orders are being passed in the background to further erode our democracy, the environment, our health care, or our rights? Who's watching the back channels? Anyone? Well, I think this has probably been the problem since the beginning of this administration, right? I mean, there's always been the bright, shiny object. And then we see what's been happening to the judiciary. We see what's been happening in our departments of state. We see what's been happening in the EPA. We see what's been happening in FEMA. We see the back drama that's happening in Homeland Security. So Tom makes a very good point. I would defensively argue that we also cover those issues, but...
I mean, yeah, I mean, part of the Trump strategy is distraction with, you know, incendiary tweets or something, and that kind of shifts the focus to what he's saying instead of what's actually happening, which is, you know, deregulation. There's talk about making his tax cuts permanent, which is an incredibly bad idea. So, yeah, this is part of the administration's MO.
I would say that this is not a shiny object, though.
No, that's right.
I mean, this is the 30-year history of the Supreme Court.
Yeah, this is major, significant. It's going to have a long-term impact on so many things. During the break, we were talking about how this Supreme Court, if it continues to go in the direction that it's going, is you can probably look forward to individual rights falling and corporate rights growing, and that doesn't bode well for individuals in the next 20, 30 years or sooner even.
I'm just going to say this, that if we look at our country and we think about, you know, the last 100 and, let's say, 30-plus years, right, what have we seen, and what has the Supreme Court done to change our culture, and I would say that I wouldn't even be able to be in the studio here with my colleagues and my friends, were it not for the makeup of the Supreme Court. I would also say that, you know, people who are same-sex couples would not be able to enjoy the same, you know, benefits that we enjoy. In this society, we now have, I mean, I'm shocked, just as a lawyer and a person who appreciates, you know, our Constitution, you know, I'm shocked that a baker.
Remember when you were in the majority?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm shocked that in a country with all that we have been through, right, all of the challenges, the cultural challenges that we've had, I'm just shocked that a baker could say, I'm not going to bake a cake for you. Because
I don't personally believe
because,
that.
Yeah, my religion, right. Yeah, yeah, my religion and my faith trumps your right to live your life that way. And the fact that the highest court in the land, under its current configuration, right, couldn't revert back to, you know, the decisions that it made in the 50s and the 60s to see that, wait a minute, we don't put these rights above the rights of the society, and we, because tomorrow. It may have nothing to do with same sex. It could be the way that I look. It could be a tattoo that I might have on my neck. It could be the amount of melanin in my skin, and the idea that no one seems frightened about that because we can divert our attention to religion and say, okay, well, yeah, we're standing up for a baker's, you know,
religious rights.
Yeah. To me, is just it's frightening. It's frightening, and yet we begin this slow and steady march. To make America great again as it's defined by people like Donald Trump.
You have a neck tattoo?
I was just about to ask. Are you planning on getting one?
I do not have a neck tattoo, Mom. Mom, yeah. I do not.
Aaron, can you say the same?
Yes, I can.
They're everywhere else.
My parents know I have tattoos. My students know I have tattoos, but there is nothing visible right now in a long sleeve shirt.
All right. I'm just a big fan of Mike Spain's tattoo.
Yeah, I know.
It is pretty flashy.
Killer. It says Killer Ink. Does that say Killer Ink?
But it's surrounded by the First Amendment. So that's good. Yeah, it's all good. Two questions for David Soares here from our listeners. One from Daniel, who is a Brooklynite, and he says, Kavanaugh's alleged actions constitute attempted rape in the first degree under Maryland criminal law. There is no statute of limitations. questions. Why isn't Dr. Ford going to Montgomery County, Maryland, and their prosecutor, which would likely have to impanel a grand jury? She should. Perhaps her legal team is using this as a negotiating point where, for example, Kavanaugh withdraws or we seek his prosecution. Thoughts?
Let me just say that, first of all, there is this woman is not sitting back engaging in the level of calculation that is being attributed to her one way or the other. I think that for those of us who have never been in this situation, I think we have to understand that for a victim to choose to come forward to discuss something that is so, you know, an experience so horrific, an experience so personal, takes a tremendous amount of courage. There is no negotiation with something like this. I think that this person, you know, unlike the average or what I would say, unlike other citizens who have experienced the same things, you know, she's putting herself out on a global stage and opening her and her family and her community up to attacks the likes of which none of us will ever experience. So this idea that that she would be engaged in some form of negotiation or leveraging is just it's not correct.
No, I appreciate hearing, David, as a prosecutor who's handled cases involving sex crimes and attacks and sexual abuse, the sensitivity your office ordinarily has when a witness steps forward to talk about their themselves being the victim of a sex crime and testify against the alleged attacker and the dynamic there and how that compares to sitting in front of a Senate hearing on television live, possibly. And I don't know that they're still saying Kavanaugh would be in the room, but that you know, just knowing that he's going to walk in afterwards or he was just sitting there right before it. I mean, how the two are so completely different.
There is not a single prosecutor or courtroom in the United States of America or a prosecutor in the United States of America that would ever conduct an interview of a victim of a sexual assault in the presence of a defendant. As a matter of fact, the amount of work that it actually takes to work with a victim for the services to be in place to get a victim to the point where they can walk in the court of law in the presence of a judge, in the presence of a jury, armed security, and be able to stand there and to point out a defendant takes a tremendous amount of courage. And so the first time that I heard, might have been Chuck Grassley, who said they can both come and provide testimony, you know, at the same time, it was just outlandish and absurd.
Yeah. Do we really think this hearing is going to happen? I mean, now they're talking about it not happening on Monday, at least the lawyer, you know, for Dr. Ford is saying that. But I mean, it just seems beyond belief that this hearing would actually
happen. A hearing
happen.
On it's, Monday. The idea. Right, yeah, the yeah. idea that this person well, finally comes forward and discloses on a Monday and all of a sudden is going to be asked to come in a week later. Right. Yeah. To provide, you know, detailed and subject herself to what I imagine is going to be, I can't even say cross-examination, because in a cross-examination, there are boundaries. Right. So you're talking about boundaryless, you know, elected officials who, you know, are putting political expediency before fact. The idea that any lawyer would subject their client to that environment is absurd.
You know, and talking about that environment, I mean, let's just rewind our memories to 2 weeks ago when those hearings, we ran the hearings from start to almost finish, except for the wrap-ups, here on WAMC. Well, there were outbursts in the room every 10 seconds, and it was far from a civilized setting. Can you imagine what... Mm-hmm. Of what the now I don't know if they're talking about public or private or how those particular hearings could work, but could you imagine the atmosphere that would be there for this woman to testify?
Oh, yeah.
I mean I can't imagine what that would be in the sense of not only just the stress of having to do what she's doing in the sense of answering questions that are going to be posed to her. But then there's just the environment that she'll be in, which is, yeah, I mean, she's making a point about her safety and her family, rightfully so, I think.
And there's another consideration here. And for us, you know, in this business, when we have something that is volatile, you'll have your gang cases, you'll have other cases where witnesses or victims are threatened. You know, you have to take special precautions and make provisions for that person's travel to the courthouse. You have to consider, you know, different entrances and exits for your victims and witnesses. And so the idea that this person on Friday or on Thursday is going to be invited to come in on a Monday, and given that the time when she's going to testify is being provided publicly, knowing that there's a universe of trolls out there, the touchstone terrorists out there that continue to demonstrate their courage over social media, it's absurd. You would never subject your victim to an environment like that.
Yeah, I think there's a larger point, too, which is something that we were talking about during the break, and that is the country is becoming much more politically polarized, where you have a younger generation who doesn't view socialism as a bad word. They look to the, you know, the European model, which is not socialism. It's not that the government's controlling the means of production. It's just that you have government providing certain programs and institutions that soften some of capitalism's rougher edges. And then you have a Supreme Court, especially with the Kavanaugh nomination, if it were to go through, that's trying to sharpen those edges. And this doesn't bode well for the next, you know, 50 years of the country, where you have a populace who's wanting one thing and a Supreme Court who is, you know, demanding another thing. And it's just not a healthy way for a democracy to function.
We've seen social revolution before, and we're begging for it again. You know, we've done a lot of talking about the victim in this case, but let's just talk for a moment about Kavanaugh. Why wouldn't you want the most transparent, right, process, you know, to legitimize yourself as you're being sworn in? Right.
If you have nothing to worry about.
If you have nothing to worry about. I mean, why would you even stand by and allow a document dump, you know, in the 11th hour of the night before you come in to testify?
It's not about that. It's about strategy. It's about the people who want him on the Supreme Court doing what is strategically the most effective to get him through the process and approved so he can be on the first Monday, be in robes at the Supreme Court.
I understand that. I guess my problem with all of this and my view on all of this is this. Okay, as prosecutors, as judges, right, you're different. You're different than the average politician. You could be a politician once every 4 years when you have to run for office, right? But the way that you conduct your office, the way that you conduct your investigations speaks to the way that you engage in due process, right? So the idea that you have a political strategist on your team that is developing all of these, you know, really fast-tracking ways to get you into that position, it undermines your credibility in terms of the work that you ultimately have to do. So every decision, you know, that will be published by this person, the average citizen would look at it and say, you know, why would you undermine yourself? Why would you let your political strategy undermine your efficacy?
Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we do have, I mentioned there were two letters for you. We only got to one of them. So again, I still got another one for you, David.
Is that my mom asking about my neck tat?
I think she has suggestions. She drew up some designs, actually. We'll be back right after this. Okay, here's question two. Jim asks DA David Soares, Mark Judge, the possible witness to the alleged assault, said he won't testify and does not recall the event. Sounds very legalistic and a non-answer. Can he be forced to testify under oath?
He can be summoned by the Congress. He certainly can. He can be subpoenaed and forced to testify.
The question is,
but
really,
I think, But I think he's kind of, in his response, he's sort of let you know exactly what he's going to say.
I have no recollection.
I don't remember.
Senator? No.
You know, I'm going back to something that I said earlier today at the beginning of the program, and Mike clarified a little bit. But I do think you look at this. We knew about the letter starting on, I think, a week ago Thursday, right? And we knew about the letter. And then by Saturday, we knew who wrote the letter. And by Sunday, there were calls that we should do something about the letter. And then by Monday, we were saying, okay, there's going to be we have to delay the vote that would have been yesterday. And all of that happened really quickly, really, 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 really quickly. And now it just seems that this negotiating process over the last several days, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, today, has been painstaking. I'm not saying it shouldn't be, but it seems as though there's not going to be a quick resolution. I'm wondering if that is part of an overall strategy to say, we know that Senator Grassley laid down the law and said we need an answer by Friday. They gave a sort of answer on Thursday night, Dr. Ford's legal team, and said, look, we're willing to do it. Monday is not possible. And so what happens next? I don't know what to expect from today. I know they're looking to make a phone call and to discuss how they're going to work through it. But it seems to me that it's like a hurry up and wait kind of thing.
Yeah. The problem that I have here,
wait and then hurry up.
I guess the problem that I have here, in my analysis, is that the allegations, her suffering, her experience, is second and perhaps third in all of this. No one's thinking about the doctor. No one's thinking about her. Everyone's thinking politics. You know, all of this is political expediency. All of it is calculation. All of it now are the strategists that are engaged in what they're going to be doing. Well, what if we delay the vote? What if we wait until a week from today, Friday, to allow her to testify? What then? That's the only discussion that's going. That's the only calculation that's in play here. Whether or not what she experiences, her safety, the safety and the health of her family, is irrelevant to these people.
We did get this from Jackie, who writes and says, the sexual behavior of Kavanaugh is despicable with regard to Dr. Ford. However, no one seems to be talking about other matters. One, Senator Leahy says that Kavanaugh stole Democratic documents while in the Bush White House, and the possibility that Kavanaugh perjured himself when he said he knew nothing about it. Two, he was the lead guy in the accusation that the Clintons killed Vince Foster. Three, he was involved in the Bush Gore Florida boat. Four, the $200,000 debt that was mysteriously wiped out?
I think there were a lot of people that before, Christine Blasey Ford came forward, had already decided that he was unfit for this role. And I think those were legitimate issues that were raised, and that the Republicans and the president probably should have come up with another candidate. But at this point now, it's almost a battle of ideologies. I also wanted to mention that just a few minutes ago, we were talking about, I had said how remarkably, uncharacteristically restrained the president of the United States was. You guys didn't agree with me so much, but the fact that he wasn't attacking her, well, that ended. At 9:14, the president of the United States tweeted, I have no doubt that if the attack on Dr. Ford was as bad as she said, charges would have been immediately filed with local law enforcement authorities by either her or her loving parents. I ask that she bring those filings forward so we can learn the date, the time, and the place. So he's now thrown her under the bus and said, essentially, if this really did happen, or it was as bad as you say. So now we're equivocating how bad the sexual assault was.
It was a tweet?
Yes, that was a tweet at 9:14.
And it didn't end with no collusion.
No collusion. Right.
Which or sad.
Yeah.
Well, you make America great
again. I got to tell you, this is at least keeping the discussion of the Russian interference in the election on the back burner.
Oh, my God, that New York Times article.
Thanks for sending a nice short piece to digest.
Yeah, I know. Talk about a data dump. Yeah. I thought I'd send you like a 47 pages.
Mike
was spared this. Yeah.
My eyes are still twitching.
I've seen the story already.
I figured you had already perused it. We'll talk about that and other stuff. We welcome your letters. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. Mike Spain, Aaron Pasitti, and David Soares making up the panel. Ray Graff is doing his...
A salute.
But Ray Graff is doing his vocal warm-ups. We'll be ready for news right after this. Felt like I was hearing confession there for a moment, David. I don't know.
You were.
Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. And to our panel discussion this morning, we have Mike Spain, who is the associate editor of the Times Union newspaper. We have Aaron Pasitti, who is an economics professor at Siena College in Loudonville, New York, my father's alma mater. I know I say that all the time, but I say it proudly because I was supposed to go there and I crushed his heart by saying, yes, but they don't have a communications program. So can I go to the College of St. Rose instead?
They do now.
I know. That's right. This
That's
is a long time ago. This is when the college was in black and white, Aaron. And the district attorney from the county of Albany, David Soares.
I'm from Rhode Island, so I would have said alma mater.
Alma mater.
Yeah, I was just in Rhode Island about 2 weeks ago. It's a beautiful state. It really is.
Beautiful people there, too.
Yep. Very nice.
Well, let's move on. We have a couple letters, but I'll get to those a little bit later. Well, I just want to advance the conversation a little bit. We were talking about data dumps, but there's this article in the New York Times. If anybody gets a chance to see it, it's really incredible. Here's the title of it: "The Plot to Subvert an Election: Unraveling the Russia Story So Far." That's the headline, and this is a 75-page deep dive into trying to put all the pieces together into what happened regarding the Russia story and all of the players in the story. And it is exhaustive. I would even say exhausting, but it is, you need somebody to put all the pieces together. Scott Shane, Mark Mazzetti of the New York Times have done this, and they say here in the note, for 2 years, Americans have tried to absorb the details of the 2016 attack, hacked email, social media fraud, suspected spies, and President Trump's claims that it's all a hoax. The Times explores what we know and what it means. Aaron.
Fortunately, I read that yesterday afternoon instead of this morning because I would probably still be reading it if I had to start this morning. It's fascinating, and I think it highlights probably the most important root cause, or at least the way I see it, the root cause of this is that, so why is Russia getting involved all of a sudden? And I think Putin has some very legitimate objectives from his perspective, and that is to subvert the idealized version of Western democracy, and that legitimates his and his allies' more authoritarian rule, so that the Russian populace doesn't get any crazy ideas about maybe a regime change or something. He also wants the sanctions that the U.S. has imposed on Russia eliminated, because that is definitely an economic crimp in their development. And then he also is looking for, freedom for military operations in former Soviet territories that he thinks are rightfully Russia's. So that all makes perfect sense. The tough thing, so in my opinion, I don't think he really cared who the Republican nominee was. I think Russia would have gone along with this no matter what to try to, disparage Clinton and at least tilt, upset American democracy and hopefully have some type of, polarizing candidate. And it was a bet that paid off. But what always had me scratching my head was, what did Trump have to gain from this aside assistance in getting the presidency? And I think there's two things. One is economic and the other is entirely personal. And start with the personal one. As a childish narcissist. He just looks for adoration and adulation from strong-arm people. And that is, you know, if this tough guy Putin likes me, then I must be a tough guy. And, you know, that kind of validates his own opinion of himself as this chest-thumping businessman. But I think there's an economic motive that's probably driving Trump just as strong, and that is, since his business finances have never been clean, I think he's declared bankruptcy four times, that a lot of banks and financial institutions see you know, the Trump organization as
a
legitimate
risk.
Yes, yes. So, you know, funding might be, you know, the credit he has access to might be reduced. The interest rates on loans he wants might go up. So he's got another source, and that is all of these Russian oligarchs who are willing to bankroll a lot of his projects, some of which he's trying to get off the ground in Asia and in Russia specifically. So both of these men, Putin and Trump, have an economic interest in forming some type of weird alliance, and this benefits both of them in ways that I don't think Putin could even have imagined when this all started in 2014, that it would end up with Trump being so kowtowing to Russian interests.
Well, I agree with you. For me, what I was able to appreciate from this article is the fact that you had these reporters that were sitting in a room and they were actually thinking like prosecutors. They were building their case using every single bit of public information that is out there. Now, the difference between, you know, the war room at the New York Times and the war room in the Bob Mueller's special
counsel's
office,
sure.
is that you also have additional information that's provided by way of grand jury subpoena and also confidential, you know, information provided to you by CIs. That is the fundamental difference between the two. But I could really appreciate the painstaking effort that they went through in really laying all of that out and then creating the timeline and putting these pieces together. Because I think what we suffer from in terms of electronic media is conflation, is because if you're watching Fox News, they're going to spin a fact a certain way. If you're watching another network, they're going to, you know, spin a story another way. And then if you're reading anything on any kind of social media platform, the very platforms that were invaded and leveraged by the Russian spies, you're going to get an entirely different set of facts. And so this was particularly eye-opening for people who have not yet taken the time to really consume and take in all of these issues that have existed now for the past 2.5 years that have been right in front of us all along.
Yeah, I assume this is the front page centerpiece for the New York Times on Sunday, and it will probably have several pages with big, huge graphics. But those graphics are available online, and some of them are dynamic and sort of move and can it help explain this? But David, I wondered, does someone like the special counsel, like Mueller, can it be assumed that he has access to Donald Trump's tax returns?
Tax returns, and, you know, believe it or not, tax returns are nearly impossible for anyone to get, including prosecutors with subpoena power. What we often do when we suspect that there is a collateral issue involving taxes is that we will send a referral letter to the State Division of Tax and Finance here, but it would be the IRS. And then there would be an independent investigation, and if there's a finding there, then they'll come forward and provide you with information, but you're not going to be allowed to look at tax information.
That's very interesting.
Deeply private.
Yeah, because I think that would always reveal and support what Aaron was getting to, and that is where Donald Trump turned to for financing when conventional arrangements were no longer favorable for him. Yeah,
I would say that the only thing I disagree with you is the fact that I think that for Putin, I don't think it was just personal against Hillary Clinton. I don't think it stopped
yeah,
there.
Yeah.
I think he is obsessed with reclamation, with the idea of bringing the Soviet Union back, and the idea of is destroying NATO, as the late Senator John McCain would say, that Russia is a gas station in Europe. the economies, I think, if you compare the economies, I mean, Russia hasn't the same economy as the state of Texas, and I think California has a larger economy than the entire country of Russia, and therefore Putin has been seeking those opportunities to rise in prominence again and to place, you know, the Soviet the Russia on the same level as the United States, and boy, did he find the perfect foil for it.
Yeah. And, you know, again, the other bizarre thing is how much this runs counter to Republican orthodoxy of, you know, whether it's, you know,
traditional Republican orthodoxy.
Traditional Republican orthodoxy of, you know, this is a non-democratic country. They're, you know, invading Ukraine.
Exactly. Traditionally, it was the Republicans in the House of Representatives and the Senate who were the most opposed and the most harsh with Russia.
Right.
And here we have almost the opposite happening. But I think it has another end result too, that it probably was part of the plan, and that is undermining Americans' faith in their own political process and creating and fueling cynicism and by doing that, shooting down participation by people being so cynical about our own political process that we will not engage. And that only when people stop engaging and stop, you know, paying attention to what's going on and stop participating in elections, that has an enormous long-term effect. That's really something playing out right now.
Yeah, it's not only disengagement, but I think Putin was also trying to further polarize a country that was becoming increasingly polarized, mm-hmm. which makes any type of compromise almost impossible. So it's not only, it creates a stalemate in U.S. government, and that leads to disengagement, which leads to further stalemates and
exploited every single fracture that we
right.
have along racial
exactly.
lines, along gender and orientation mm-hmm. and economics. Mm-hmm. He exploited all of those things.
And you should note that this is there's plenty of evidence that Russia was doing a very similar thing across Europe, Western Europe, and fueling the hostilities that ended up with Brexit. And,
yeah.
and you know, he couldn't play out any better for him than having this fractionalized
There are several things that I think also flow from this, and that is simply this. I don't know how the Republican Party recovers. You know, they mm-hmm. certainly cannot claim the mantle of patriotism anymore, seeing as how they're so willing to even visit Russia during this period of time when our intelligence agencies and our apparatus have indicated that they interfered in our government elections. But let's not let that stop our senators from visiting the country. So I don't know how the Republican Party, you know, lays claim to the mantle of patriotism when it's abandoned all of its orthodoxy towards this particular country and communism.
And they do use the flag very effectively.
And only in NFL games, though.
All right. We have some. Did you want to say? No, go ahead.
Well, one quick point is that Putin could not have picked a better time, because after the financial crisis in 2008, you had almost a decade of completely stagnant incomes in the U.S. aside from the top 1%. Jobs were increasingly difficult to find, and periods of prolonged stagnation historically lead to rightward shifts in political ideologies of that country. And this is, you know, data that goes back prior to the Great Depression. So Putin had this timed perfectly in that you had a very discontent population because of the economic crisis, the bailout of financial institutions. People were angry, and when people get angry, they're also very malleable to more populist candidates. And I think the Democrats made a huge mistake in putting forth Hillary Clinton instead of Bernie Sanders, because that would have been the populist response from the left, and I think we might have had a very different outcome.
He said the word now.
Yeah.
First time I was on the air, I mentioned something about Bernie Sanders, and I had a lady in a Prius come up to me, slow roll like a gangster.
Right.
And threaten me.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
I get you.
He just mentioned.
I'm sorry. Slow roll like a gangster.
Quiet. It was quiet, too.
Couldn't hear that motor.
Couldn't hear it.
All right. We'll all enjoy that all weekend. We have a couple of letters. This one from Elise said, I wholeheartedly agree
Or I agree wholeheartedly, as it actually says, with David, except I request that everyone start to refer to Dr. Ford as a survivor rather than victim. Survivor underscores the courage she and other sexual violence survivors require to live their lives normally, let alone receive death threats from touchstone trolls.
So true.
Yeah. Maureen says, Malcolm Nance's plot to hack America turned me on to all this info from an intelligence person's point of view a few months ago. Give him his due.
There's a record of a woman saying Malcolm and then turn me on the same sentence.
Yeah, there you
go. Save that one for Malcolm.
And Malcolm was here last Friday, and I think we gave him his due, and we'll continue to do so.
Great guy.
Yeah, absolutely. Timothy writes, could it be possible that once Kavanaugh is installed, congressional Republicans will consider Trump as ineffective and irrelevant going forward, and therefore setting up a change in attitude toward the president?
Installed.
They'll still ride that horse as far as they can, and there's probably more they can get out of him in the way of tax cuts and the reduction of rules governing the environment and trade, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
As Molly Ivan so famously said, dance with them who brung you, as it were. Anonymous writes, I was sexually assaulted by a female teacher over 60 years ago at my prep school. I have never gotten over it, nor would I ever testify in public about it. 60 years.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's
an important, that is a good letter. That's an important thing to understand, that this survivor, Dr. Ford, it took a long time for her to resolve it and deal with it with her psychologist, and then suddenly the person she believes and is professing attacked her is in the public light to be on one of the most important jobs in our country, and it just must be torture.
And Anonymous is her courage for even sharing her experience with us this morning, because that's the experience there that provides the perspective that is necessary to understand what is happening right now in this moment. We have survivors of clergy abuse that experience the same thing. It takes years, and the current statutes, the way that they are, that provide for, 1 year after the age of maturity to bring forward civil lawsuits just isn't enough, because people are not ready to come forward and do what they need to, what they feel is necessary in that year.
It's when we talk about all during the campaign and even in the 2 years since President Trump has taken over. Many on the left and progressives have said, well, the last thing we want to do is normalize any of this. And I think that in some cases, just as a culture, well before the election of 2016, we normalize a lot of things. We normalize violence. We normalize sexual violence. We normalize because we talk about it. We see it on TV. It's weirdly, dare I use the word, entertainment. I mean, we have a show called SVU, and I think it does get desensitized. And so that when you have somebody who had something traumatic happen to them 60 years ago, you look at it, some people will look at it and say, oh. But instead, the power of that and the understanding of what the person has gone through is completely lost.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think for the political pundits, this has been in their space for a period of 13 days.
Right.
And here you have a woman who's speaking to us right now. Who's had to live every single day of her life for 60 years with that trauma.
Well, we will end there. I was hoping for a brighter note, but I can't find one, so we'll end there.
It is Friday.
It is Friday. It is Friday. We're going to let our panelists go and take on their days. David Soares, thank you very much. Aaron, always good to have you here. We'll see you next Friday. And Mike Spain, good to have you here. Thank you. We'll be back with more program right after this.